Everyone, thanks for coming in. The Subcommittee on Workplace Safety and Respect will come to order. We do have a quorum present, and we do have minutes now after our first meeting. Representative Fenton, did you get a chance to review them?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did. I moved the minutes from February 26, 2018.
Thank you, Representative Fenton. Moves the minutes. Are there any corrections, changes, comments? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. Again, I'd like to thank everyone for coming to the subcommittee. Today we'll be doing a couple things. First, we'll be hearing from our House nonpartisan research staff and from our ethics committee chair on the current ethics committee procedures and constitutional provisions on member discipline. After that, we're going to have an informational hearing only on Representative Lesh and Representative O'Neill's proposed amendment to the House rules. And then finally, as I mentioned in the previous meeting, we are going to have some outside experts, and we'll start today with one of those experts. And I guess with that, if Pat McCormick and Mary Mullen could introduce themselves for the tape and begin, I'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pat McCormick from House Research.
Chair and members, I'm Mary Mullen from the House Research Department.
Mary and I are going to talk about two things today that are separate but related. The first is the House Code of Conduct, and the second is the Ethics Committee and Ethics Procedures. First, a couple preliminary notes. The Ethics Committee is specifically designed for allegations rising to the level of scrutiny by the entire body. So that it has a specific purpose within a broad range of ways that members are disciplined. And at the end of my presentation, I'm going to go through that broader range. So as we go through this, I want you to keep in mind that the Ethics Committee has a specific process within a range of ways that members are disciplined. Before I go into the ethics, though, I'm going to talk just a little bit about the House Code of Conduct. The House Code of Conduct, which is in your packets, was adopted after PhoneGate, after the early 1990s scandals. Codes of conduct are of an era. They come and go as management tools, and the literature on usefulness of codes of conduct are divided. The key thing that a code of conduct does for an organization is provide a framework for ethical decisions by the people who are subject to the code of conduct. The House Code of Conduct applies to members and to legislative staff, House staff. Article 9 of the Permanent Rules of the House requires adoption of a code of conduct and updating when changes are made. The House Code of Conduct was last updated in 2007. It is adopted and is permanent and ongoing. The Ethics Committee drafts proposed codes of conduct, and when those are approved, those are sent to the Rules Committee for adoption and then applied to the body. This code requires House members to uphold certain principles and certain goals. Unlike an employment policy, and last week we had the employment policy on discrimination and harassment, unlike an employment policy, this code of conduct requires adherence to broad principles of democracy and decorum. It exists in addition to and beside the expectations of the electorate and of civil society, and those expectations that apply to all members and staff of the House. It implicitly incorporates the policies and rules of the House. The Ethics Committee is not designed to handle all behavioral issues that apply to members. It is designed to come into the process at the end of the broad range of ways that members face discipline. And I'm going to talk about those at the end of the presentation. In some sense, those broad ways that members face the discipline answer is a question that was presented in last week's hearing where people asked, well, what do we do if a member does this? What do we do if a leader does this or that with hypotheticals? And I'm going to try to run through that, a broad set of answers that tries to answer and provide a framework for understanding how the broad range of member conduct is handled. the membership of the Ethics Committee is equal, bipartisan, two members from each caucus. There are additional members from each caucus as backup members. The Ethics Committee adopts and uses a set of rules that are adopted every 2 years in House rules, and Mary's going to go over those rules in a minute. It's key that the members are the deciders, the people who decide how to apply it, the ethics rules and procedures of the House to other members. And members, as part of the process, may abstain from voting. They may have closed meetings. They may have executive session meetings. The complaint that arrives at the Ethics Committee is about member conduct, and the contents of the complaint are always made public. But the committee can meet in executive session to review complaints and may keep certain records confidential. And staff are required to keep member information confidential. The establishment of an ethics committee, I'm going to turn over to the actual procedures to Mary in a minute. The establishment of an ethics committee is optional. The Minnesota legislature did not always have an ethics committee. In fact, the key constitutional provision, which Mary's going to go into in a minute, requires the entire body to punish members and not a subset of the body. And one way that ethics procedures have been handled in both our Minnesota House and Senate and in other legislatures is with the appointment of a select ethics committee to deal with a specific ethics complaint. So there's a question that legislatures face. Should we have an ongoing permanent ethics committee with ongoing rules and with members who have expertise like Representative Erickson, or should we instead allow the speaker to create a select committee on a case-by-case basis? We've chosen over the last about 50 years to have an ethics committee that persists and exists over time and to have ethics procedures and rules which govern the ethics committee. One last preliminary comment before Mary gets into how the ethics committee works. I think it's important to understand that the goal and the use of an ethics committee is not to protect the members. It's to protect the electorate that chose to send the members here and to therefore allow only ethics complaints that rise to the level of misconduct that brings the House in disrepute and therefore prevent any third party or ongoing attempt to use ethics procedures in a political sense. And the reason is that each member of the House is elected by 40,000 Minnesota residents and citizens, and they have chosen that member. And so the tools and punishments of the Ethics Committee are serious and offer an avenue around the voice of the electorate. And so both the Constitution and the House rules therefore make it hard to use an ethics complaint in order to protect the voice and rights of the electorate who sent the members here. So with that, Mary's going to get into a little of the actual details of how the Ethics Committee works.
Chair and members, this is Mary Mullen from the House Research Department. I'm going to start by talking a little bit about the history of the Ethics Committee and the basis in the Constitution and its jurisdiction regarding member discipline. The Minnesota Constitution authorizes each House to determine its own rules and punish its members for disorderly behavior. This provision mirrors the federal constitutional provisions, and many other states have adopted a similar clause in their constitution as well.
Could you just move the microphone a little closer? Thank you.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to tell you a little story quickly. One of the first legislative disciplinary actions that happened in the United States was in 1798. It was in U.S. Congress when a Vermont congressman spat tobacco juice on a congressman from Connecticut. And in that case, that back then the U.S. Congress was very small. There weren't a lot of people in it. But they did have a House Committee on Privileges, and they referred the issue to the House Committee on Privileges, and they heard testimony and made recommendations to the entire body. And then the U.S. House of Representatives voted on the motion to expel the congressman from Vermont for disorderly conduct. It was a very close vote, but they didn't expel him. He made it by two votes. Over the years, the U.S. Congress had to grapple with ethics compliance, as did many state legislatures. These happened in a variety of manners. They used special committees, investigative subcommittees, special counsels. And then finally, in 1967, the House created the Committee on Standards of Ethical of Official Conduct, which they later renamed the House Ethics Committee. A number of states followed suit in the 1970s and 80s, and similar to that, Minnesota established the Ethics Committee in 1989 to make recommendations to the full House. The House has jurisdiction over members' behavior. This includes activities that violate norms of the House, betrays the public trust, or behavior that includes potential criminal activity. Really, the jurisdiction is very broad. The Ethics Committee is tasked with reviewing complaints against a member. House Rules 6.10 provides when a complaint can be brought against a member and the House ability to discipline a member. So what do you need to file an ethics complaint? An ethics complaint needs to be in writing. They need to be signed by two members. A copy needs to be provided to the accused member and to the speaker. Generally, supporting materials are included, and the complaint is provided to the committee. The committee can act in an investigatory capacity, often looking for information from outside the legislature, which would include civil or criminal actions related to the issue that they're looking at. They can hire investigators or special legal counsel to assist. And ultimately, they're going to provide the House with a recommendation for disciplinary action. The ethics proceedings can resemble a court proceeding, and in that sense, they attempt to provide sufficient due process rights to the accused members. This includes a right to notice, a hearing, to call and cross-examine witnesses under oath, and to subpoena witnesses and to review the evidence before them. The committee is one of the other things that they have a right to is they have a right to be represented by an attorney, both the members bringing the action and the person who's accused. So the committee is supported by nonpartisan House research staff, but the House counsel doesn't act as an attorney to either the accused member or the member bringing the complaint. They would hire outside legal representation. The committee itself can also, when with approval from the speaker, consult with outside legal counsel, either to provide specialized legal knowledge or to perform an investigative function. And I'm going to turn things back over to Mr. McCormick.
I'm going to have you look back, Mary, to the slide 4. I just want to hit a little heavier on the head the constitutional provision. And it's Article 4, Section 7 of the Minnesota Constitution. And there it establishes that each House may determine its rules of proceeding, sit upon its own adjournment, punish its members for disorderly behavior, and with the concurrence of two-thirds, expel a member. But no member shall be expelled a second time for the same offense. And I wanted to hit this a little broader on the head to make the point that the Constitution gives the ultimate right to punish members to the members. And I'm going to forward a little bit and go back to our next point, which is to talk about what punishments the Ethics Committee may recommend. And the first is that the Ethics Committee can find a complaint to be frivolous. And so the Ethics Committee does not have to recommend punishment. They can find a complaint that is subject to alternative dispute resolution. And in the proceedings of the Ethics Committee, there is provision for the Ethics Committee to offer alternative ways that ethics complaint can be handled. They can find that there is a violation of House policies or norms, but that these violations were inadvertent or technical, and that discipline or punishment is not necessary. They could caution a member. They can fail to find probable cause, clear and convincing evidence for disciplinary action. Or the Ethics Committee may find evidence for disciplinary action and may recommend a final disposition. That can include censure or reprimand, expulsion, financial restitution, remediation, including counseling, training, or other discipline. I want to hit on the phrase which I said very quickly, and they may recommend. The Constitution gives the power of punishment to the body, and the Ethics Committee has the power to advise and recommend to the body. So if the Ethics Committee decides that a member should face one of the punishments that I just listed, then the Ethics Committee would draft a resolution which would, and a committee report, which would go to the House for debate. And these resolutions have been debated and amended. They are amendable on the House floor. So a hypothetical recommendation from the for censure, for example, could change, be amended by and debated on the floor, and then the body adopts the punishment. And as noted, the Constitution does not let a member be expelled without two-thirds of the members. And so that is a barrier to punishment. These difficulties from the requirement that two members actually bring an ethics complaint to the require that the full body implement a punishment are designed to make it difficult to move quickly and easily to expelling a member who came here having won an election with 40,000 votes. And so I wanted to finish my presentation by outlining ways that members face different kinds of disciplines short of an ethics process, because I think it's important and it answers questions that were raised at the last hearing when people said, how do we deal with, for example, a leader who doesn't do their job in relation to a harassment complaint? And this is not an exhaustive list. We just sat thinking of all the different ways that you face different kinds of discipline and from different organizations. But the first way is caucus action. Members have been excluded or asked to leave a caucus and no longer be allowed to be in a caucus. Short of that, members have been given lower amounts of caucus support and as a way to say that your behavior is not meeting the standards of the caucus. Caucus leaders can be removed within the caucus by vote of the caucus. And so the caucus has a wide range of disciplinary procedures, including expulsion of members, which have been used and are used. There's actions by the speaker or minority leader that can affect a member. Removal of members from committees or chair positions. The speaker just noted earlier this year in regards to the mandatory training that people will lose their chair or committee assignments if they don't attend mandatory training. That's a punishment that the speaker can put. Minority leader has, and majority leader and speaker have some authority and control over where members sit on the floor and can move them around. The speaker himself is subject to election by the entire body and so can be removed by election of the entire body. There are actions outside the legislature that members are subject to, including criminal and civil liability for crimes and torts. Party discipline and reelection issues that all members face from the electorate that are a way for the electorate to enter in and discipline a member. And you note the constitutional provision says you can't be expelled for the same offense twice. That envisions that a member could be actually expelled under an ethics debate by two-thirds of the body and then win re-election. And the new election wipes the slate clean and the body cannot expel them for the past crime a second time. And public scrutiny is another important way that members are disciplined. So these different ways, short of an ethics complaint, form the day-to-day ways that members' behaviors are constrained and the norms that behaviors have to follow. And then the final step is the ethics committee and the ethics process, which comes from two members making a complaint. This is our simple overview. We'll answer any questions.
I think if it's okay, we'll have Representative Erickson come up. Did you have some words too? And then also of note, we did ask the minority lead on ethics to come forward too. She wasn't able to make it today. So we'll bring Representative Erickson up for a few comments, and then we can take questions on any of these witnesses. If you two could just stay here as well, in case there's questions, if you don't mind. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm Sandra Erickson, State Representative, House District 15A, and Chair of the Ethics Committee here in the House. And I have to tell you that for the past 20 years, this committee has been chaired either by Representative Mary Murphy or by me. So we both have a great interest in helping our members to understand the code of conduct. And Representative Murphy declined to attend today, but we have visited numerous times and worked together very well. I think the chart that you have before you, the flow chart, and the explanation by our presenters really lays out the pathway that is available to members and to our staff to hold us accountable as public officials and employees of the public. And because we have the complaint process, and it has to be in writing, and it has to be signed in an oath, there is a process in place right now, I think, to bring decorum to our House floor debate, to committees, to other behaviors among our members that is working very well. It is true we did last revise this in 2007, but in each biennium that we have met and even processed complaints, we have found this process to be invaluable to our members and to our staff, and I would recommend a continuation of this, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you, members. Do we have questions for any of the witnesses? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have two questions, and one is a general question. They were both raised in the remarks from Mr. McCormick. Mr. McCormick, when you said it takes two-thirds of the body to do an expulsion of a member, is that of members present at the time, or is that of the 134 members would constitute the body?
Mr. McCormick?
I'm sure that's two-thirds of the 134 members.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll?
Second question. Mr. McCormick referenced the fact that the Speaker has the ability to take disciplinary action, and this might have been covered at the meeting last week when I wasn't here, but did everyone fulfill the requirements for the training? Do we know that?
Representative O'Driscoll, I know 134 members did attend. All 134 did attend the training.
Thank you. I just, like I said, maybe that had been covered, and Mr. McCormick brought it up, and I just wanted to jog my memory to ask the question. Has everybody completed the training that was required? Thank you.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to clarify, through this formal process, both the accused and the accuser are named, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson. The complainer and the complainant are both named. That's correct.
Thank you.
Fenton.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Just one. So then, and those hearings are public, always public?
Madam Chair, Representative Fenton, those hearings are public. The only time we would close would be for executive session if we believe that as a committee of the whole of ethics, we needed to discuss something other than the recommended procedures in front of us.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Erickson. One last question. So if maybe a complaint is made to someone higher up, but they make a general complaint, are not willing to name anybody yet, then basically that superior cannot go through a formal process. Is that correct? Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Fenton, if a member or two or three or four want to file a complaint, at least two must file the complaint and submit it to the Speaker, and the complaint must be specific about the behavior or the aspect of the code that was violated. And without that, the Speaker cannot advance the complaint to the Ethics Committee. So the process at the beginning is very specific. And as you heard Mr. McCormick say, usually the Ethics Committee is the last place to which a behavior concern may come because there are other ways to resolve. But there is a specific process. So if there is not that process followed, then the Speaker does not accept the complaint.
Representative Fenton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Erickson, but as part of that specific process, the accused must be named, correct?
Oh, excuse me. Madam Chair and Representative Fenton, yes.
Thank you. No further questions.
Any questions over here? I actually have a question, I think, for Mr. McCormick. I was reading in the rules book. I was reading 6.10, and I'll just, everybody should have it, but I'll read the line in which I have a question. It says, it's on the top of page 27 in our rules book, rule 6.10. It says, the existence and substance of a complaint, including any supporting materials, and all proceedings, meetings, hearings, and records of the Ethics Committee are public. And Representative Erickson talked about this a little bit. Does that mean the letter itself, the complaint itself, what exactly does that mean? That is every anything that was even named? And my concern here is that two people could make a complaint, but that doesn't necessarily allow for due process before that comes out. So if you could just clarify exactly what that means.
Madam Chair, members, I've always read that in conjunction with the remainder of the sentence, which allows the committee to meet in executive session to determine probable cause, but also to consider a member's medical or other health records or protect the privacy of a victim or a third party. So a complaint, I've always read it to be that a complaint which has to be specific and which has to come from two members could come to the Ethics Committee, and elements of that complaint could be things that the committee or the person would like to have remain private. And in that case, the Ethics Committee would meet in private session and consider those. For a hypothetical would be a medical record, which is exculpatory or explanatory, but that the person doesn't want to have made public. We would review that, and then counsel would advise the Ethics Committee on how and to what extent we could report those private confidential details in our public report. It hasn't happened in that way, but if it did, we would talk to our data privacy attorneys and try to craft a way that the maximum amount of public information can be made while protecting the private. And if there's a multiple accusers, for example, that would be a second hypothetical, and some of those accusers don't want their names to be made public, but two members of the House have signed a specific complaint, then perhaps in a private session we would look at some of the statements from the private accusers who don't want their names made public and then decide to what extent we would report on those to the public. Because we still want to validate both data privacy laws and the right of people to privacy, and so we would struggle to find a way to do that.
Thank you. So it sounds, Mr. McCormick, like there is a little bit of flexibility. So if the media just said, I demand to know the name of the accuser and the accused, there is some of potential for the Ethics Committee to review that and make decisions based on the specifics of the complaint?
Chair members, correct.
Okay. And Representative Schultz also has a follow-up question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there's no guarantee that the victim would know there'd be confidentiality before the victim discloses information. So is there any assurances that this could remain confidential in the executive committee?
Mr. McCormick?
Madam Chair, members, I think it's first of all important to note that the Ethics Committee in certain cases would be built off of a set of procedures that you heard last week from Ben Weeks and Kelly Knight about how harassment and other complaints would be handled by the Human Resources Office. And a complaint hypothetically could come signed by two members that has already been a part of that process. And I think that we would have to discuss with the chair and with the vice chair of the Ethics Committee how to go forward and how to review and how to give the maximum privacy. But you're correct. In the end, there's no guarantee. In many of these cases, we have to deal with what comes in the door to the Ethics Committee.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to be clear, though, also, the only way the meeting is closed in an executive session is if a majority of members of the whole committee vote to go into executive session, right? So they have to agree. So, and if I remember correctly, there's two members of the majority, two members of the minority on the committee. So there would have to be a vote essentially of at least three quarters of the committee to go into executive session. So, potentially partisan considerations could be a factor there, I would think. I mean, there's no guarantee. Like if somebody requested, this is more of a comment, I guess, than a question. If somebody requested an accuser a victim requested to go into executive committee, they would have no guarantee that there would, in fact, be an executive committee. They'd have to rely on the fact that at least three members would vote for there to be one in the first place. Is that, that's an accurate statement, right?
Mr. McCormick?
Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee,
Representative Erickson.
I think you need to know that members of the Ethics Committee do not discuss anything about a case that comes before us. We pledge not to discuss with one another. So I have no idea how my colleague is going to vote or what he or she may say, and that is true also on the DFL side, that Representative Murphy and her colleague, as well as the alternate on both sides. We do not have any conversations about these cases. This is all done in public without our knowledge of anyone else's thinking.
Thank you. I just have one additional question, and this is on the bottom of page 26, where it says the speaker must refer the complaint to the Ethics Committee for proceeding or for processing by the committees according to its rules of procedure. What would happen if it had, if the complaint was against the speaker? Would that default, who would that default to then? Or how would that work? Would it just go automatically?
Madam Chair, members, if two members sign a complaint against the speaker, our belief is that this is a ministerial duty of the speaker and that the speaker would be required to forward it and had no discretion. The most discretion we've ever considered that a speaker would have would be if a complaint came without two signatures, and then it would not be a proper complaint. If it's proper per the form and required rules, the speaker must forward it.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for the witnesses? Okay, thank you very much. And next, we're going to have an informational hearing on Representative Lesh and O'Neill's proposed amendment to the House rules. If Representative Lesh and Representative O'Neill could come forward. And again, this is informational only, so there will not be a vote or amendments or anything like that. We're just going to listen to the proposal and take it under advisement for a later day. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I think what we'll do here is I didn't talk to you about this, Representative O'Neill, but Representative O'Neill crafted this together based on certain considerations that have occurred over the course of the last 6 months now. We'll have Representative O'Neill proceed first on why she thinks our proposal is important, and then I'll follow up with the details of why that's okay with you. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Morning, Representative O'Neill.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for having us here today. As you all know, we've had several sexual harassment issues within the House of Representatives that resulted in two members, one House, one Senate, leaving. And they did not go through an Ethics Committee hearing, which is concerning. I'm a strong believer in due process. I'm a strong believer in confidentiality. As we were, you were just discussing, that most of these proceedings, unless the executive or the majority of the Ethics Committee decide that it should be private, are public. I have dealt with sexual harassment and sexual violence and other things legislatively for years and feel that it's time. We haven't changed the rules since 2005 or 7, I can't remember, 7, 2007. I think it's time to review them, particularly in light of the Me Too movement, particularly in light of there's a movement afoot among women to actually tell their story, and I think that we should be there on their side and be able to help them to tell their story. Something also became apparent as we moved through this whole process with these two members, again, one House and one Senate. The public really didn't have an avenue to launch a complaint. It was, you had to go through two members of either body in order to move a complaint. And I think that that is an important thing for the public to be able to do, that if a member is acting inappropriately, particularly with sexual harassment issues, that the public should have that avenue, and there just wasn't a clear path for them. So this offers a clear path for the public as well to file a complaint. So for those reasons, I joined with Representative Lesh, and we went over this proposal really with a fine-tooth comb, and he was gracious enough to make many changes that I had suggested and thought would make it better, particularly with some of my work in the past with sexual violence, sexual harassment legislatively. So, and I know we have someone from Mincasa here, so they graciously are in the audience today as well. But I've worked with them on many occasions to move our statutes forward to protect women in a greater way. So with that, I'll turn it over to Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Madam Chair, members, I have been in the House now for 16 years. And over the course of those 16 years, you hear things. You don't know what's true and what's not. But I found myself over the years wondering several times about individuals that are here to petition their government for a redress of grievances or whatever constitutional right they have to be up here. And there are absolutely power dynamics at play. And I found myself occasionally looking at more senior lobbyists who've been around a long time, especially female ones, and staff members, and wondering the things that they have seen. You know, if these walls could speak, and would we be proud of the situations that our fellow members engaged in, or would we be ashamed of that? And I just don't know the answer to that. And as a man, as a straight white male, I am certainly not in that position to see as much of that as some of my colleagues or friends or lobbyists would be. So I found myself wondering about that, but with seemingly little recourse to do anything about it, or so I thought. In the wake of the Me Too movement, there was an additional willingness to understand and see what was really going on, especially in Hollywood, but also in politics. And when that occurred, I had conversations with several people. And with what the news reports that had happened around here, I began talking to folks, members, but especially lobbyists, because members have a certain unique recourse, an election certificate. It makes you different as a member. There are still absolutely power dynamics. But when you come up here as a citizen, or as a staff member, or as a lobbyist, there are absolute power dynamics which limit your recourse. So in considering this, I spoke with Representative O'Neill, and I would also be remiss if I did not point out that there are a couple members who did desire to, I think, weigh in on this. This proposal brought forth by Representative O'Neill and I is not perfect in any way, and we didn't intend it, I think, to be perfect. We intended it to be a conversation, because that conversation needs to be had. But I believe Representative Maquaid and Representative Beckerfin, they raised some concerns to me that they may want to bring up with this later. I've also raised concerns with me from several lobbyists that I know. And they said, they looked at this proposal and they said, you know, your Representative O'Neill's proposal still has me as a lobbyist sitting before a group of your peers who would sit in judgment of you. And I'm not going to put myself in that position. Okay, and that's a very valid complaint. It's an absolutely legitimate complaint. At this point, and I think this is a topic for this committee, I don't know how to get around that with the constitutional restrictions of separation of powers. We are very limited in what we can outsource for authority over us. We can still do it, but as was stated just previously, we are the ultimate arbiter under the Constitution of who sits in this body and who does not. So that's a conversation that needs to be had. There may be a way around it that I don't know about it yet. But with that, I would go into some of the thoughts that Representative O'Neill and I had about what should happen. Now, the conversation up until this point in the committee about the Ethics Committee, when I first came here 16 years ago, it was made clear to me that the Ethics Committee is the place where ethics complaints go to die, because it's split even up. And it's done that way for a reason, to protect against partisan bias. And so the suggestion is that things don't move out of there, because the only way to get something to the Ethics Committee is to have two members sign off on a complaint. And those are always two members of one party against a member of the other party, which means by design, it is a partisan process. Now, that's not always been the case, but it defaults that way often. I know that because I was part of that. Very early on, I was asked to do my job as a as a junior member to file an ethics complaint against another member, and I did it, absolutely not knowing what I was getting into at the time. And it turned out to be a completely partisan process. It was not pretty. It was ugly. I think Representative Erickson probably remembers that. Anyone else around here? Representative Erickson, I think you were the only one who was here at the time when that happened. I was disappointed with the process at the time. So when Representative O'Neill and I talked about this, we thought, okay, I can't necessarily do anything about that. That's a process that needs to be worked through with the Ethics Committee. However, when it comes to accusations of sexual harassment, which should in no way be partisan, we thought that what about avoiding the tendency of something to go to the Ethics Committee to sit there because action can't be taken on it because it's split dead even. How about requirements, number one, for timelines where decisions have to be made by our own rules. Rules can only be undone on the floor by a two-thirds vote, which is high majority. So rules set in that say timelines have to be met. Number two, protections for complainants slash victims. Protecting them from being dragged through the mud by saying that at least the initial determination of probable cause is non-public. Okay? The protection that that affords an individual who is in a negative power dynamic, such as a lobbyist, means that they do not have to go public with their complaint and risk their career. They can bring their complaint forward privately, and then the Ethics Committee decides whether probable cause exists for a complaint to move forward. After that, the complaint and the identities are public. However, the lobbyist, staff person, whoever it is, or member, has the protection of already having had their words validated by a probable cause determination. So it is much more difficult for them to be attacked as saying that they're making a frivolous or superfluous complaint because this determination has been established by a body of the peers of the person who is accused. Again, you know, these are areas that may be criticized, but these were the ideas that Representative O'Neill and I came up with. Also, the Ethics Committee has to bring on an outside consultant who can help make a determination based upon best practices, legalities in the workplace of what procedures are commonly used, and whether or not those procedures were properly followed by the House or by the member who was accused, you know, or by the complainant, even for that matter as well. So the Ethics Committee is guaranteed to receive this advice from an outside individual who is an expert in the area. So that was another facet of it. One other piece that I think I wanted to point out about this this issue is what Representative O'Neill brought up in the way of a public process. And this may be fairly criticized about it being a public process. However, when the Me Too movement occurred, there was a very public conversation in our nation about what is happening and what should happen. Now, we've had these conversations before. I was in law school during, you know, Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. And there was this big conversation, and, you know, I still remember Jerry Maguire, what was that, 1991, where he made a move on his assistants. He's like, oh, I just pulled a Clarence Thomas. She's like, no, you didn't pull a Clarence Thomas. Yeah, I just pulled a Clarence Thomas. Well, that idea of that conversation going into pop culture in a major motion picture is a part of how we change behavior. It gets into people's heads subconsciously about, hang on a second, that's something that I can't do anymore. The only way that happens is if we have a public conversation about it. And my concern about what has happened over the course of the past few months is that there were summary resignations with no conversation. And I think when that happens, the conversation does not happen, and then there is not an effort to change cultural behavior. There is a consequence. Everyone, especially leadership, is allowed to say, well, we fixed that, we're good. You know, everyone's trained now, we're good. And as we know, I think that doesn't happen without a public conversation of what's proper and what's not, which is why I wanted And we wanted this to be a public process whereby cultures, the culture of the place would change. So that was the first foray that we wanted to offer, and we fully expected that it would be fully vetted by this committee with hopefully a better product coming out the other end.
Thank you so much for bringing this proposal forward. We will open up the questions now. Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lesher, Representative O'Neill. First of all, thank you. I know when you first presented this bill that in some of the media it was good bipartisan effort was recognized as a good first step. But I do have a couple questions regarding some of the language. Can you talk more about what a non-public probable cause hearing would look like? Who is that body that would make up the hearing process? Who are those people?
Representative Lesh.
Sure, well, thank you, and I'll say...
And that's from 2.30 on the bill, if anyone's wondering where I'm... line 2.30.
Thank you for that question. And Representative O'Neill and I talked about this. I will tell you my idea of what that is. That is the Ethics Committee. Mm-hmm. Okay. The Ethics Committee makes that probable cause determination in private, after which, and honestly, the standards for what probable cause would be up to the Ethics Committee.
Okay.
So I don't know. But our intent in offering the language was that it would be the Ethics Committee that would be the probable cause determiner.
Okay.
Thank
you. And then I have a couple more questions. But pertaining to 3.12 and 3.13, first of all, what would be considered reasonable attorney cost?
Representative Lesh, an attorney.
Yes, now, these provisions are permitted in law in other situations, you know, and like in a family law case, a judge finds attorney's fees permissible to be collected by the non-prevailing party. The attorney that wants to collect those attorney's fees has to submit an affidavit, what they charge per hour, and justify the hours. So if you come in and say it took 10 hours for me to draft this complaint, and any attorney worth their salt know that it's like you're talking 3 to 4. They would say, no, we'll allow the 3 to 4. Your fees are within the range of what we find permissible, so we'll permit that. But it's completely within the prerogative of the House to do that. But there are mechanisms for that in the law, Representative, in Article 3 courts. That I guess I would presume that we as an Article II institution would follow, but that would be up to the Ethics Committee as well.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if the accused, and again, I'm going back to section, starting in that paragraph, 3.12, if the accused were found to actually be guilty of the complaint, why should the House have to cover their legal fee?
Representative Lesh.
Oh, well, Madam Chair and Representative, they shouldn't.
Okay, so, okay.
Senator Fenton?
But it says accused and accuser in paragraph complaint may request reimbursement by the House for reasonable attorney costs. And I know you give it up for approval by the House committee, but should there not be included something that states if found guilty, it should be out of your own pocket? Or
Representative Lesh?
Madam Chair and Representative, the operative word there being may,
okay.
I would not presume that the House would approve any cost for someone who was found guilty. But there is a scenario, I guess I could envision, where it's possible if the accused was not guilty and was completely innocent and was the subject of a completely unjustified smear campaign, I would probably expect in those scenarios most of the times the House would still not reimburse their costs. But there could be a scenario in there. But, you know, we're not wedded to this language. I mean, if that needs to be changed, that could be changed.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lesh and Representative O'Neill, so I have an election certificate. If I didn't like this, or if anybody here with an election certificate doesn't agree with your proposal, they could have their own bill drafted and present something, correct?
Chair. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Absolutely. And we would encourage people to bring their own ideas, which we have. I know that Representative Lesh has spoken to his colleagues that had concerns and encouraged them to write something and bring something to this subcommittee and process it through the committee process. Absolutely. This is, I think, maybe one of the first things out of the gate in writing of it as a suggestion, but it certainly isn't, you know, the perfect thing. But we're trying to bring something to have a conversation and move something forward.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I am concerned with language in line 2.22, and this section refers to sexual harassment and discrimination, that within 7 days after receiving a complaint, the leaders must refer the complaint to the Ethics Committee. Are you concerned that this would, as it stands now, would really deter people from coming forward if a complaint must go to the Ethics Committee, which you cannot assure confidentiality or privacy?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the reason that we're doing that is so that we don't have any ambiguity, that these complaints need to be taken seriously, that these complaints need to go to the Ethics Committee, which is the proper place where it should go. And that's why we also included the evidentiary hearing part of it, the probable cause hearing, the merit part of it, be non-public. So if that complaint is brought forward, there's still a condition where the Ethics Committee can be a closed committee. They will review the evidence, they'll look at the reports, and that is a non-public hearing.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To me, I don't interpret it as non-public, that you need the approval from the Ethics Committee to have to go into an executive committee, which is non-public. So to me, there doesn't appear to be an insurance that it would be private.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh.
I don't know where it is in here now. The intent was, and I think it might be in, where it says the probable cause hearing is non-public. That's on line 2.29 and 2.30. And let me just clear up, it is our intent that any complaint, number one, it get brought by the majority leader and minority leader to avoid the suggestion that this is, you know, partisan. It's not two members of one party. Which wasn't your question, Representative Schultz, I know that, but the intent was that that complaint is absolutely non-public. And I would add one thing here that I forgot to add. There is a companion bill on this proposed rule change that we dropped at the beginning of session two. The reason that that bill is required is because the Minnesota Data Practices Act, Chapter 13, does not apply to the legislature. And that the privacy, the non-public nature of that complaint needs to be sacrosanct. And without the Minnesota Data Practices Act applying to the legislature, there is no legal incentive for a person like the accused who knows the identity of the complainant to remain silent. But by applying the Data Practices Act to the legislature, the accused or anyone who knows about the complaint is in violation of the Data Practices Act if they disclose the name of the complainant. We dropped that bill to make sure that those data practices penalties exist to ensure the confidentiality of the accuser slash victim. And so that is the intent. If the language does not achieve that, then it should be fixed, in my opinion.
Madam Chair.
Senator O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I would direct your attention to 2.30, where it says a non-public probable cause hearing is required. And just before that, it talked about all the components of that hearing, which includes the complaint, supporting material, all proceedings, meetings, hearing records, and so on. And everything related to is non-public, and that's pretty well spelled out, I think. And if it needs to be stronger, we can make it stronger. But the plain reading says a non-public probable cause hearing is required.
Questions? Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On line 2.18, it says that the complaint has to be delivered to the accused, but the complaint in the complaint it must redact any identification. It seems, I assume the intent behind that redaction is to protect the identity of the accuser. However, I mean, when we hear about these harassment cases, there are always very specific facts behind them, whether it's a text message with specific content in it or a specific action taken by the member. And it says on line 2.13 that the complaint about the member's conduct must present with specificity the factual evidence supporting the complaint. So it seems to me that even if you redact the identity of the accuser, it's not going to be very difficult in most cases for the accused to figure out the identity of the accuser. Do you have any response to that?
Representative Flesch?
I don't know how to fix that, Representative Freiberg. If you're being accused of something, you're going to need to know what you're being accused of. Part of me, you know, is I've got the shackles. Sometimes the liberties being a lawyer affords additional ability to do stuff, and sometimes being trained as a lawyer restricts that. But I am committed to certain constitutional principles that say if you are accused of something that you should know what that is. But, you know, I guess I would wonder if there's another proposal about how to handle that, because at some point I'm presuming that everyone would agree that the person is entitled to know what they're being accused of. But I don't know. I guess I don't have a good answer of what a better fix for that would be.
Madam Chair. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. If the person that is being accused committed that particular act, of course he's going to know who the other person was. I mean, that's sort of common sense that if he or she actually committed that act, he would know who he or she committed the act with. So, yeah, I don't know how you get around that, because if it's a legitimate complaint, they're going to know who it was that, if it was somebody that was making something up, well, that's a different story, and that's what the probable cause hearing is about.
Representative Freiberg?
I guess then what is the purpose of the language saying that the identification has to be redacted?
Well,
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The obvious reason for the redaction of the identification is to protect the discrete identity of the complainant. At some point, if probable cause is found, and even at the probable cause hearing, which the accused can attend, the accused will discover the identity of the accuser victim. But in the complaint itself, the intent was to follow standard procedures that we have in the courts, whereby a person is not named directly, but when it's a juvenile or someone who qualifies under, let's say, the Safe at Home program, we will use initials rather than their name, because it's not just the accused who we're trying to protect the victim from. It's also other people that may learn of the complaint, may find the complaint. If the complaint is leaked, we don't want to directly disclose who that is at the time. It's, I think, an art more of a science in protecting the identity of the victim, and I don't think there's any conclusive way to perfectly achieve it. That's the best answer I can give you.
Representative Portman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And do I understand we're just hearing this on an informational basis?
Correct.
I'm not voting. Representative Lesch, as a lawyer who's, I think, prosecuted and defended, one concept I guess I would just bring to your attention is that there's no requirement right now that I can find that the complaint be in good faith. And the way it's written, it sort of contemplates there are either violations or there are not violations. There are no alleged violations, which may be found not to be violations. And so I think addition of the words good faith and alleged in various places in the draft would make sense. The other thing that's, you know, I think it's good that you refer to on pages, on page 3, lines 3.4 and 3.5, to an outside investigation. I really think the tricky part there is you have the investigatory report coming before the probable cause hearing, but we still have this problem of we're all partisan members of the legislature, whether we like it or not, we have a party designation. So in order to determine probable cause, before we get to that investigatory report, we have two Democrats and two Republicans sitting in judgment. And I just, you know, I think as we search for a solution here, that looking for something that's a little bit more objective and outside of the political world is something that I'm going to be looking for as we consider proposals.
Thank you. Representative Lesh?
I'm sure I think those are good suggestions. And you know, just ongoing thoughts there being, now we do require that the initial complaint be under oath, but we do not have any requirement existing now as requiring good faith, and I think that's a fair suggestion and allegation. And second, something that Representative Horman, you brought up, made me think that it may be worthwhile to include something in there to require the Ethics Committee to establish their own findings. If they were to reject the recommendation of the outside counsel, why? I mean, what's your justification for that? As we all know, a lot of actions taken against members around here, not like by the Ethics Committee, but by our caucus and stuff, depends a lot upon how much we like the person. It's absolutely true. And I've seen it happen time and time again where an annoying member receives more justice than a non-annoying member, so to speak, at times. And that's human nature. That's going to happen in anybody. However, when we are required to establish written findings, I think that would be worthwhile. And I don't know if that would be well received by this committee, but it's just a potential way to go. If we are going to reject the determination of outside counsel, there ought to be a reason for that. It ought to be stated and established and reviewable.
Other questions? I just had one question. I saw that on line 2.17, a complaint must be in writing, and I was just wondering if you could give your thoughts on that. Or do you have any fear of maybe it having a chilling effect on the victim to have to put it in writing, or if you could just talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I don't know how else you move a complaint forward if it doesn't have some substance to it and in writing and under oath as is required to go move in that direction. You know, I'm a victim myself, and it is hard. It's a difficult thing to talk about. It's a difficult thing to move forward. But, you know, we have worked with MnCASA, and we'll continue to work with MnCASA to look at, you know, how to protect a victim and help him or her through that process. But I don't know how else you would move it through without it being substantive and in writing, and unless you have a different suggestion. If it's, you know, testimony that's oral, I don't know if that's any easier. I would think, you know, for myself being a victim, I would say that would be more difficult than just writing it down.
Do you have any thoughts on that, Representative Lesh?
Well, only that, you know, I am a little bit of a slave to the Article 3 system, that being everything that's submitted is in writing, is in some verbal express content, because that sets in place the expectations and standards that we follow. You know, I honestly, if the Ethics Committee wanted to consider statements exclusively orally or in certain instances orally, I think that, you know, that could be the Ethics Committee's prerogative. As I said, as a slave to the Article 3 system, it makes me nervous because it gets more nebulous. But it may well be that that could be an unreasonable burden on on the victim of an incident. I don't know.
Other questions? Well, thank you both again for working on this.
Thank you.
It's nice to see a bipartisan effort on an issue that should not be partisan. And I appreciate you digging into it, and we will continue to look through the proposal. Okay, so last today we'll be hearing from an outside expert that has been represented to us, Sheila Engelmeyer from Engelmeyer and Umana. If you could come forward, Ms. Engelmeyer, and you could just introduce yourself for the tape as well.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for inviting me. I very much appreciate it. Let me tell you a little bit about myself so you can try to factor that into whatever advice I can provide to you all about how to handle these very challenging issues as it relates to respect in the workplace. They're at issue here as they are in every workplace. You have unique circumstances, but not quite so unique as you might think. So here's my background. I have been practicing law for 31 years. In that time, I have represented companies. I have represented individuals. I have represented some elected officials. And I have been studying intently the law on harassment and discrimination for most of those three decades. What's unique about my practice is that I'm on both sides of the fence. I talk to folks who feel horribly mistreated, and I talk to folks who feel like they've been horribly misjudged and accused of doing things wrong. The other thing that's unique about my practice is that I help businesses try to create an environment where folks feel free to come forward with concerns. Folks are held accountable when concerns arise. And even more important than the accountability piece, developing a culture where you have fewer problems in the first instance. In that paradigm, I actually think the legislature is a lot like a law firm. I don't know what percentage of folks are lawyers, but I think it's a lot of the legislature that are lawyers. And what's the unique dynamics at play in a law firm is there's all these different areas of power. There's a bunch of different folks who generate revenue and have their own source of power from the revenue they generate, or they cultivate their own sort of group of supporters. And that's very much as I look. I'm a very apolitical person, even though I went to law school with Tim Pawlenty, and I practiced law with Paul Coles, and I practiced law for a little bit with Melissa Hortman. But how I imagine this works is that it's very hard to hold people accountable because it's like you have a whole posse of folks that are backing a certain person because they've done so many things that are so good for a long time. And then when there's this aberrational behavior, it's hard to figure out what am I supposed to do. So one of the things that I think you all would be well served to acknowledge is that you aren't as different from the private sector as you think. There are other areas where there's lots of power dynamics. Take, for example, in the context of a small business, you know, a business owned by three very powerful owners, or even 10 or 20 very powerful owners. It's hard among those owners to hold each other accountable. So I think the linchpin for this body going forward is going to be demanding of each other, like as part of the process of being a part of the legislature, you're each going to hold each other accountable. Making a pledge at the beginning of the session, I read your code of conduct, but making a pledge at the beginning of the session that if I myself do not hold myself accountable to the code of conduct, I voluntarily will step back from serving if it's in a significant way, rather than setting up an elaborate process for hearings and requiring folks to speak under oath. I think that has to be undertaken with a lot of caution. So basically, I have some comments, if you're interested in them, on what I've heard about the proposed legislation, and I applaud this body's efforts to look at these very important issues. I also wanted to let the committee know that I'm somebody who, between 35 and 50 times a year, sort of sits in a room and mediates disputes between employees and employers, a lot of times on issues of harassment. And I can tell you that there is great reluctance to communicate openly about issues of this nature. And you're going to have to, whatever you decide to do, you're going to have to factor that into your thinking, because whatever process you engage in to facilitate the opportunity for folks to come forward is going to have to include an opportunity to do that casually rather than in a super formalized way. Let me just tell you what I passed on to Megan, and I don't know if you passed it on to the whole subcommittee. So just so you, some food for thought for you all to think about. I essentially gave you four things. Interesting timing, the Bench and Bar, which is the state's magazine that goes out to all lawyers, came out with three articles on the issue of the Me Too movement just this month. Chuck Lundberg, who is a renowned ethics person advising lawyers, did a piece on how what law firms need to be mindful of in the Me Too era. The second is a piece that my colleague and I wrote about how to favorably impact culture in a law firm. And again, food for thought, because I think the legislature is similar to a law firm. The third piece is a commentary on the Me Too movement by the president of the Minnesota State Bar Association. And the fourth piece is an article that I've written. So in the last two decades, I think it was about 20 years ago that I was asked by the American Bar Association to come and speak in Seattle on the development of the law as it relates to what is and what is not harassment. And I wrote a piece that I've updated probably 17 times since then, and I've given you my last iteration on that. But basically, my advice to this body as somebody who regularly deals with avoiding these problems in the private sector. The issue of harassment in the workplace is a little bit like cancer. And that is to say that if you remove the illness, you don't remove the problem. So the one person leaves. If you have a culture that still facilitates that kind of problem, it's going to come back. You know, when you think about treating cancer, you think about it in the context of you have to make an environment where cancer can't thrive in order for it to go away. You know, change the kinds of medicines you take, change the way you eat, things of that nature. And I think harassment is very similar to that. I think your code of conduct is a good start towards asking folks to commit. But why, as a person who's never held office, I wonder why can't at the beginning of every session each member formalize their commitment to be in an environment where, number one, you will not act disrespectfully in the area of harassment towards others, the public, your colleagues, lobbyists, and number two, that if you see someone else doing it, you'll call them on it. So if those two kinds of promises were made at the beginning of every session, I know that myself, as a person who votes for folks like you, I'd be pretty troubled when later I find out that someone did not want to step back when a group of informed people took a look at the problem and decided that there was a failure to be respectful. Because let's remember that there's a whole spectrum of behavior. There's everything over here being mildly rude to meeting the standard of legal harassment. And with your permission in a moment, Madam Chair, I would like to just say something about the law as it currently exists, because it's something that should inform this committee as well. But so So I throw out there for you to consider what kind of commitments you could make on the front end to each other and to the public at large. And I would suggest that you consider a less formal process than the one outlined in the bill that was being considered, which I think is a laudable start. It's really cool to see my legislature at work trying to get something going. However, what I'm concerned about with respect to that very formal process is, having done this work for more than three decades, it's going to be very difficult for folks to swear under oath to A, B, and C happened and provide all supporting information. It's very difficult for people to do that. I see that over and over and over again in these hundreds and hundreds of mediations that I've handled over the years. And similarly, I think if you're really trying to get to the bottom of a problem, handing the person who's accused of doing something wrong the allegations against them doesn't always lead to that result. For example, in the private sector, if I were, let's say this were my workplace, if I were trying to figure out whether Melissa Hortman mistreated this young lady over here, I would go ask each person individually. I wouldn't just single out Melissa Hortman, because then she knows it's her who's on the hot seat, whereas if Melissa Hortman is a bad actor who's repeatedly done the same thing over and over and over again, there's many people that might have information about that. There's many people that should come forward and, you know, talk about those things. And I might get some data from a lot of other folks, and she's not going to know right away that it's you who raised the issue. So I suggest you think about tweaking that. You've already done your work with respect to training. I know the folks who did the training that you guys had, but training by itself doesn't cut it. It has to be actually walking the walk once the training is over. And I'm sure we've all read enough in the paper. You know, we don't know what's true and what's not true, but there's a critical mass of information going back decades about a pattern of behavior that I would be concerned about if I were running, you know, this work group of the legislature. I'd be concerned about that history, but what we have to do is forgive ourselves with our history. We have to say that is what it is. All we can do is go forward. And so I invite you to think about what you might do in that going forward situation. Let me tell you just a couple of thoughts about the law, and then I'll open it up for any comments anybody has. So how many folks in this room are lawyers, can I ask? Is that inappropriate of me to ask? Okay. So something very odd has happened in the law of harassment in Minnesota in particular. And you all should be mindful of this, and I think it's something that how many people remember the Americans with Disabilities Act when it first passed in the early 90s? That was a George Bush law, that the idea was to allow more people access to the workplace. Great idea. Not necessarily favored treatment, but removing impediments for disabled people. That law passed in the early 90s, and the case law that came out between the early 90s and the mid-2000s essentially made it impossible for anyone to win a disability case. Over that time frame, less than 6% of the folks who asserted they were discriminated at work based on disability had been successful. So when, during George W.'s tenure, the Americans with Disabilities Act was essentially beefed up, the courts over that time had narrowed the law about what is disabled so small that no one fit within it almost at all. So with the Americans with Disabilities Amendments Act that was passed under George W. in 2008 and became effective in 2009, the legislature sort of said, hey, we meant what we said back when we said it in 1990. We meant that folks with disabilities should have full access to the workplace. A very similar thing has happened in the discrimination laws and harassment. And I'm just going to take a couple of minutes to educate you about that. So some of you may or may not know that Minnesota passed its Civil Rights Act in 55, 9 years before the Title VII So it was way ahead of the federal government in leading the charge against discrimination. Similarly, harassment became illegal in Minnesota many years before it was illegal on the federal level. In fact, the Minnesota Human Rights Act defines what is harassment. And harassment is defined as unwelcome sexual advances, requests for sexual favors, or other verbal or physical conduct or communication of a sexual nature when that conduct or communication has the purpose or effect of substantially interfering with an individual's employment or creating an intimidating, hostile, or offensive employment environment. That law that was codified in after a case called Continental Can by the Minnesota legislature is very different than the federal law. And what's happened from the time this law was passed in the 80s to now is the courts have narrowed their definition of what is harassment. This article that I gave you outlines essentially how narrow that window is. So when you guys are thinking about accountability for harassment within the confines of the halls here, one of the things you have to think about is the law right on this issue? Because what has happened is, for example, and I apologize if this sounds vulgar, I'm not attempting to be that. There are cases in this jurisdiction where folks are asked to perform oral sex, or folks are asked what their sexual fantasies are, or employees are asked to take their clothes off, or employees are asked to sleep with people. And the courts have held that is not enough to be harassment. That is mere boorish behavior. And I tell you that just so you know when you're thinking about these issues, because when I think of the stool of accountability and moving forward as a legislative body as it relates to not condoning harassment. One leg of the stool is being internally accountable as an organization to avoid that happen. Another leg of the stool is having the right training and having the right policies in place and following them, which is even more important than having them. And the third leg of the stool is there accountability elsewhere if necessary? And I would invite this committee to consider whether, much like the Americans with Disabilities Act between H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, where the case law kind of messed everything up, we shouldn't have cases that stand for the proposition that holding your penis out at work for a mere 3 minutes isn't enough to be harassment. We should go back to what the legislature originally said, which is what I read to you, and say we meant what we said when we said unwelcome sexual advances that interfere with work are illegal. So that's what I wanted to share with this committee based on my knowledge, and if anybody has any questions, I'm happy to take them.
Questions, members? I have a question. I think one of the things that we have to grapple with is, viewing or balancing the rights of the victim and also the due process rights of the accused. And so just like your perspective on that, how do you ensure due process but also ensure that the victim's voice is heard?
Well, so I heard the folks talking about having an ethics committee evaluate a situation. So in a private sector scenario, or in, we've represented schools for years, so, there's due process rights to whenever you're a public employee. And in the confines of different kinds of public employees, the accused does not have the right to receive all the data at any particular time. So at some time in the process, not within so many days, not within so many weeks, not within so much specificity, just at some point before a decision is made with respect to them. So that's the concept of due process. I would invite you to consider that more meaningfully makes the issue of raising concerns more likely. What I'm concerned about what I heard this morning, about having 7 days, within 7 days, the other side, the other person accused gets the information. It's due process typically in the context of a public sector employment to receive the information within meaningful time to respond. It doesn't have to be before any kind of proceeding happens. And the other thing I noted about the proposal is this clear and convincing standard. That certainly seems like an extraordinarily high standard for someone to be held accountable for behavior if it's violative of your policies. And I know of no other circumstance, public sector, private sector, anything else, that would require that level of proof, which is higher than the standard for convicting someone of a crime.
Senator Portman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Engelmeyer, when you think about clients that you've had, and you have a range of clients, I'm sure, and parties in mediation before you, where you've seen a workplace deal with a complaint well, and you've seen a workplace deal with it poorly. If you can just talk to us for a few minutes about the difference between, you know, whether it's you as a defense counsel with a client walking in and you see a set of facts and you say, oh boy, to a defendant walking in and you say, okay, it looks like you did what you were supposed to do, or in a mediation where you feel that, you know, the party that's being accused has, the employer has taken the right steps. What are sort of the hallmarks of really screwing it up or really handling it well when an issue comes to light?
Ms. Engelmeyer?
Sure, thank you. So I'm just going to answer handling it well first. So what the law requires with respect to private and public employers is to have a process where it's easy for someone to raise a concern. It's not hard. So, for example, when you guys are thinking about should your concern be in writing, that would be totally inconsistent with what would be appropriate in the private sector or in the public sector employment to require someone to put in writing, or a school, that sort of thing. So the first test of whether the employer is doing the right thing is how easy is it to raise a legitimate concern. The second test is, speed. How promptly are issues addressed? Because what we know about human behavior is by the time someone is upset enough to come forward, they're in rough shape. So, you know, most times in the mediations I've handled, I'd say, gee, why didn't you say something like 5 years before, or 4 years before, or 3 years before, or 10 months before? Well, I was hoping it would go away, is sort of the sort of standard. So there is some pressure to address things in a meaningful way. The other thing is to do a fair investigation. So for me personally, I've investigated more than 100 incidents of harassment. And I don't march in with, here's what the allegations are, tell me what you think. I walk into a workplace and say, hey, what's going well in this workplace? What's not going so well? And then ask a bunch of peripheral questions to narrow down. You might get some meaningful data. So a real investigation that actually looks at the whole culture is a measuring stick for good behavior. And the last thing is taking steps that address the problem. Let's say in the worst case scenario, you have a rape in your workplace, but you had no reason to know that that person was a rapist. And it's completely fair that the law says if once I as an employer learn that this bad thing happened, I stop it right in its tracks. I have no liability for that. And so the taking action piece is sort of the what the law has wrong. The law has the standard wrong. If I'm not speaking clearly, I want to say clearly to this committee the severe pervasive standard that is currently in play in the courts in Minnesota is ridiculous. It's silly. you almost have to be raped to qualify as a sexual harassment victim. Having said that, what the law has completely right is that it should totally be fair that when employers do the right thing or individuals who are responsible for other individuals do the right thing, there shouldn't be liability for that. I mean, you can imagine that the really messing it up is everything that's just the opposite of what I said. You know, anything that makes a person when they come in feel like maybe I don't believe you is a challenge. So, for example, I once had a case maybe 25 years ago where each of the women who was mistreated was asked, well, what did you do? And that made them all feel like, hey, I must have done something wrong. So by the 10th person who experienced that process, folks stopped coming in to talk about it. I don't know if you have any more specific questions about what to do wrong, but, you know, you can make a lot of favorable. One of the best stories I tell folks about is if people are sincere, and this is the one thing we all ought to be able to agree on regardless of party, and that is that no one deserves to be harassed. And so, for example, if I knew one of you had done something that I thought was out of line, as your peer in the legislature, I ought to be able to walk up and say, hey, have you ever thought about how that might feel? And raise that concern rather than go through this whole formal process. That might be more of a help to improve the culture than a full-blown hearing on any, you know, just educating each other.
Senator Portman?
Just one more question on why it is that so many women and some men have experienced this and are reluctant to go forward. You know, what do you have to say about there are a lot of people, you know, we see it in Hollywood, of course, in the media the most, especially around Oscars time, that these things were happening and people didn't come forward. So what are the things, you know, that cause people to not want to come forward, and what are the things that we can do to create a culture where people feel that they can come forward?
Ms. Engelmeyer?
Sure, thank you. Well, a couple of thoughts I have on that. I can tell you that the single biggest fear, you don't need me, an expert, to tell you this, people are afraid of retaliation. People are afraid of losing more than you gain by stopping the conduct. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons that when I heard about this proposal and having to, you know, I envision you have to go to this probable cause hearing as the person who's making an accusation. And I would be concerned about that because that's asking a lot of folks. The more you ask of folks, whereas in a typical private sector or public sector employment job, if someone came to any leader in an organization and said, hey, here's what's going on with me, that leader has an obligation to act, to try to fix the problem. No specific formula for fixing the problem, but a very clear duty to fix the problem. So, you know, you have to create a culture here where people feel like everyone's focused on fixing the problem rather than punishing. You know what I mean? The notion that it's not about whose hide you got or who had to withdraw or who had to resign or but that there was a material difference in the day-to-day conduct of folks at work.
I have one more question.
Sure.
And it's about the complaint process. And one of the first things that you commented to Representative Portman's question was the ease of the complaint process. So there have been, I think, other proposals in other states, and I've heard suggestions about anonymous calls email. Just your view on how effective is that if someone has a complaint to call in a hotline or an anonymous email?
Hotlines are very effective. They're partnered with the right investigation. And in fact, that what we know is that people much more often will report on a hotline than they would in anything where they have to submit a written communication. So you'd have to have experienced investigatory folks. And, you know, one of the things that we, you know, when we're in an environment where, let's say a law firm, very similar analog to you all, has had a bad egg, just bad stuff happen. So something where where the leadership stands up and says, that's the old days. We're now starting the new days. And, you know, sometimes that bad egg still stays because they're good in many other respects. They just have, you know, a boundary problem or a glitch or something as it relates to respectful treatment. And if folks can stand up and say, hey, I'm sorry, I own this, I'm moving forward, I'm going to do better, here's one way you can hold me accountable is to call this hotline or talk to any one of your colleagues, that helps.
But on an actual complaint, would they, if somebody had a complaint about, for in our case in the legislature, about another legislator, would they be able to, would it work to be anonymous the whole time, or would at some point they have to come forward, and what would be the accused right and to be able to
sure.
figure out what the, I mean, if I were accused of something, I'd, you know, I feel like I'd want to know, or that I would have a right to know who was making the complaint against me or what the complaint was. So if you could comment on that.
Sure. I have, I guess I have two reactions to that. It kind of depends on what your main priority is. Is your main, are those equal? Is it equal to avoid the misconduct? Is that the number one priority, or is it an equal priority with protecting the due process of, if they're equal priorities, then you want to, early and often provide information to the accused. In most paradigms, the improving the environment is a higher priority than the due process rights of the accused, especially when you're in a scenario when you know there have been a history of problems. So in a paradigm like that, where the higher priority is to have an environment that's respectful and free from harassment, hopefully in a hotline scenario, you have the right people fielding the hotlines. You ask folks whether they are willing to reveal information so you can fix the problem. I can tell you that in the more than 100 investigations that I've handled, I'm almost always able to talk the person into coming forward because you just say, well, that's the only way we can really make meaningful change. So if you had the right staff doing that, now the biggest concern they're going to have is when is this other person going to find out? And it's absolutely imperative that that person have due process rights to hear and present their side of the story. But I'm not so sure, Chairperson, that I would agree that you have to tell them the name of the accuser to achieve that. You have to give them the opportunity to address the factual concerns. And, you know, in a standard scenario, at some point, the accused finds that out, but that's not the first priority. The first priority is to get all the information on the table, and so you can start the process, figure out what you have to do to fix the problem.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Portman?
Thanks. I think a little bit of the elephant in the room here is the fear of unfounded accusations, right? And I'm sure that this is as much an issue in private workplaces where there's, I'm certain, a fear that employees or ex-employees want to shake down the company. And in our line of work, the fear is that a partisan-motivated complaint would come forward that really doesn't have any basis and is merely used to destroy somebody's reputation. So maybe, I don't know if you can talk about a little bit in your professional experience in the private sector and public sector workspaces that you've seen, you know, is this what I think is the elephant in the room, this worry about unfounded accusations? How does that shake out? Is that reasonable concern?
Ms. Engelmeyer?
Thank you. Here's what I would say in response to that. I'm going to go back to my assertion that I don't think you guys are as different as you think. Because in a law firm, I've been in 7 of them, there's always people that hate other people. There's always people that are wishing for others to fail. There's, the partisanship that can impact this environment is very much at play in every competitive business, including law firms. Now, not to a greater and lesser extent, you know, General Mills doesn't have as many power brokers as, say, a 50-person law firm has. But in those paradigms, this this concern with respect to being falsely accused is alive and well, and people cooking up plots to hurt other people. And the fact of the matter is, we know from the Me Too movement over the last year or so, despite the fact that there's people worried for a long time about false accusations, the impediments to coming forward are much bigger than, let me say it differently. I would be much more concerned about not getting the real information about what's happening than I would be concerned about false allegations, because it is so difficult for most people to come forward. Now, that isn't to say there aren't false allegations, because of course there are. But there's no more so in this body than in a backstabbing law firm. And backstabbing law firms have to deal with these issues all the time.
Questions? Well, thank you so much for coming forward. We appreciate it. Members, we will next meet next Monday, same time. Representative Freiberg.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt that. It was sort of a question related to that, so I just wanted to get it in before we adjourned. I'm just wondering, you know, there was some discussion about when we heard had the informational hearing on the bill that it wasn't perfect, that you know, anybody else is welcome to bring a proposal forward if they have a different one. Would it be your intention to, if there's another bill introduced on this topic, would it be your intention to have a similar hearing on that?
Yes.
Okay. And even if it's not, you know, there could be there could be approaches to it that don't relate to House rules specifically, so it may not be in the jurisdiction of this committee. I would think even if it's in another committee, we could still hold an informational hearing on it. Is that accurate?
I don't see why not. I mean, it would depend on the proposal, but again, I think Representative Hortman asked me about the context of it, and I mean, I don't think the context of it here is to look at what outside corporations are doing, but anything that relates to the legislature, definitely we could have a hearing here, and we will also have public testimony, I think probably as early as next week, and even though in rules, as you know, we don't have to post, we will make sure we have posting so that the public will know and have the opportunity to come forward. So. Again, we're going to be meeting next Monday, March 12th at 9, again, and we will try to have some evening hearings as well, but that will be our next hearing. Representative Portman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know the agenda for that next hearing? And I was wondering, is the administration coming in to report on what they've done at that next hearing?
I don't have that. I'll let you know as soon as possible. I have some ideas, but I don't have anything pinned down, but I'll be in touch with you during the week.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else? Okay, thank you so much. With that, meeting adjourned.